Hey, Southern California, are you aware that you have rate options that could help you save? Whether you like to conserve energy, save money, or the environment, you have options. You can learn everything you need to know about time of use rates, solar rates, green rates, or electric vehicle rates at sce.com/SoCalRates. Find out which rate is right for you. And together, we can create a clean energy future. Southern California Edison. Energy for what's ahead.
Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in therapy and research. Now, long ago, I realized that I am too annoying to live with anyone and too scary on my deadline days for my column. The truth is, I'm a huge extrovert, but I've always loved living alone and then essentially ordering out when I wanted company. So going to a bar, going out with friends, having them over. And this hasn't changed in the 10 years I've been in a relationship with my boyfriend. And actually, I think we're happier because our relationship is formed around my solitariness and his and the realities of human nature, that you're going to be nicer and more loving to somebody and value them more if they show up at your door for a date than if they're always there drooling into your couch cushions. I know for a lot of people, this is a radical view, and it's a bit hard to arrange your life this way if you have kids with your spouse or partner. But tonight, we're going to talk about what used to be a radical way of living, living alone, that's become a whole lot less radical in the past few decades. My guest tonight is sociologist Dr. Eric Kleinenberg, and his book we'll be discussing is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. He'll tell us why remaining unmarried and living alone have increasing appeal, what the problems of living solo tend to be, and how we might solve them. Hello, Eric.
Hello there.
So you didn't write this book because you're a single sociologist living alone, looking to do what we jokingly call me search. You actually have a family and kids. And this book actually came out of your book on the lethal Chicago heat wave of 1995. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, you're right. You know, I'm talking to you from Manhattan tonight. I've got the doors closed to my wife's room and my kids' room, and I'm locked in another room, you know, trying to be as quiet as possible because it's 10 o'clock at night here. I am decidedly not living alone. In fact, I got into this topic because I'd written about a decade ago a book about a terrible heat wave in Chicago in 1995 that killed more than 700 people, and hundreds of them died alone. And when I discovered that in my research for that book, I realized that the topic in and of itself was significant and fascinating. I hadn't realized that so many people had died alone in that event, and I learned that they died alone because so many people were living alone in Chicago, and then I learned in cities more broadly as well. This turns out to be a massive social change, and I felt like I needed to go back and learn more.
And now you said in your book that these people, they were out of touch with friends, with family, with neighbors. They were beyond the reach of the local safety net. And so one of the issues you have is that we really aren't set up that well. Even though we have a lot of people living alone now, we aren't that well set up to accommodate it.
Well, we're especially not set up very well to deal with a society of people who are increasingly aging alone, some of whom will get frail and sick, and who will get isolated. That's a real difficulty, and I think probably many people who are listening to this conversation tonight know someone in their family or friendship network about whom they worry because they are old and alone and isolated. But, you know, when I started research for Going Solo, I really thought that I would be telling the story about a nation full of people who are living alone like that. I really thought this would be a book about the decline of community and the rise of social isolation and loneliness. And the surprise for me is that that is not really what I found. In fact, the story is far more complicated and interesting.
And so You write, starting your book, that human societies are collective societies, but now more of us are living single than ever. And this used to be a transitional state between your parents' house and your spouse's house. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, there wasn't even much of a transitional state. You would go from your parents' house to your spouse's house, or maybe you'd live in a rooming house, something collective. You know, the history of our species is a history of living in groups. And in fact, you know, animals tend to live in groups as well. One surprise I learned is that even hermit crabs live in groups. And if a hermit crab is on its own, it starts to lose its own limbs. We are social animals. And for the 200,000 years of our species, you know, that's how we've lived. But something really extraordinary has happened since about the 1950s. For the first time ever, we have seen societies throughout the world host large numbers of people who are living alone for long periods of time. And they're living alone at different points in their life. Some are young people who are spending their 20s and stretches of their 30s living alone before they couple up and get married. Some are people who get married and then separate or get divorced and find themselves living alone for years or decades. Some are older people who become widows or widowers and also find that they have many years or decades of life on their own. And so the numbers are just extraordinary. This is a phenomenon that is hardly marginal. Today there are 33 million Americans who are living alone. They represent 28% of all households at the national level. They're quite durable. And in major cities, the rates of living alone go from about a third of all households to almost a half in Washington, D.C. and Manhattan.
Now, what do you mean by durable, that they're not living alone for 20 minutes, that they are, this is their household, that's the way they're staying for a period of time?
That's right. It's a surprisingly stable arrangement, more durable than many other ways of living, like, living with an intimate partner, even in some cases, you know, living with a spouse and children. Global society, people tend to move often and change their life situation. And the best paper I've seen has living alone as the second most durable arrangement.
That's very interesting. Now, we're going to go into some of the details of living alone, but some of the history and the reasons that you get into, they're very, very interesting. And one thing that you say drives a widespread rise in living alone is the ability to afford it. And this is especially true of women, who this wasn't true of before.
Yeah, we can break that down into two things, really. I mean, first of all, let's face it, living alone is expensive, right? It's a luxury, and you can't do it if you live in a poor nation or if you live in a poor neighborhood. I mean, you're really unlikely to do it. So you need to have some basic resources. And so, you know, you tend to find high levels of living alone in relatively affluent societies, and the money can come from the market if it's a flourishing marketplace, but it can also come from a welfare state. And in fact, you know, having strong social security and health care and all kinds of public supports winds up being a big predictor of people's capacity to live alone, and we can get into that later. So you need basic resources. But then you brought up this other big point, which is that there's also an issue about the status of women. And it's very clear, you know, there are a lot of affluent societies that have virtually no one living alone, and they tend to be in relatively repressive societies in the Middle East, you know, where women don't really have the capacity to determine their own lives. When women are economically independent and culturally independent and can control their own lives and bodies, and there's affluence, you have big numbers of people living alone.
And now, another thing that you said caused created conditions. You say there were these four sweeping changes, one of them being the rising status of women and reliable birth control. We didn't mention that, but that's a part of this, where you weren't always barefoot and pregnant, but also the communications revolution, mass urbanization, and the longevity revolution, you say, with people living longer than ever before. So instead of being, you know, mom and dad having 30 good years together or 50 good years together, this sort of, till death do us part, this sort of can be a sentence if you're with the wrong person, if you don't get divorced.
Well, look, you know, there are kind of two schools of thought on this. There's the group of people who get their sociology from Father Knows Best and think that, you know, 60 years ago, you know, families were these idyllic little islands where, you know, oases from the world where there was nothing but love and support. And then there's another school of sociology that I think of as the Mad Men school. And that's really a different scene altogether where, in fact, you find people in marriages that are oftentimes lonely and isolating. You know, family life can be pretty brutal. And if you read the diaries of women throughout history, you'll find a lot of dissatisfaction with marriages that couldn't end because there was no mechanism for it. So I think, you know, there's some of each. The reality is mixed and complicated. But I certainly am not a believer in the idea that there was once this golden age where everyone was happy and that since then things have just fallen apart. In fact, marriage, when it works well, is an amazing institution and can be, you know, can produce terrific outcomes. As a married guy, I would have to say that, otherwise I'd be a hypocrite. But let's be clear, you know, when a marriage is not working well, it can be a dangerous and isolating and lonely thing. And in fact, one of the most profound things I heard from the people I interviewed, there are more than 300 interviews in this book, is this idea that there's really nothing more lonely than living with the wrong person.
Absolutely. I've written that in my column. There's no lonely, more lonely than being alone when you're with somebody else. It's just, it's horrible. I get a lot of letters like that from my advice column. I should do a station ID, and we're going to get back, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit about individualism, and then we're going to get into some of the details of living alone, how to live alone, what the problems are. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Therapy and Research. My guest tonight is sociologist Dr. Eric Pleinenberg, and his book is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. His website is erickleinenberg.com, and on Twitter he's Eric Kleinenberg, not surprisingly. So stick with us as he tells us why remaining unmarried and living alone have increasing appeal and what the problems of living solo tend to be and how we can solve them. So you had very interesting stuff in your book about individualism and that people, they like to treat the soaring rates of living alone as an expression of American individualism and self-reliance, you say. But you talk about how maybe that's not exactly the way they paint it.
Well, I should tell you that writing this book was such a profound learning experience for me. I mean, you've already heard that I went from thinking this was going to be a kind of continuation of my Heatwave book to a book called Going Solo. But when I first started it, I proposed it to the publishers as Alone in America. And I thought that the story here was going to be about how lonely and isolated and individuated Americans are. And I also thought this was really a story about the United States. An American saga about, you know, our culture of self-reliance and individualism. But it turns out that I was wrong on both counts. You know, first of all, people who live alone tend to be in many ways more social than the people who are married. They spend more time with friends and with neighbors. There's no surprise that they're more likely to go out and spend time and money in bars and cafes and restaurants. But it is a surprise that they're more likely to volunteer in civic organizations. They're really not selfish. But boy, was I wrong about this idea that this is an American phenomenon, because it turns out that the United States is a laggard, not a leader, when it comes to living alone. It's far more common in Europe. It's more common in Japan, which is known as a family-centric place. It's more common in Canada. And it's by far the most common in the Scandinavian nations, which are famous for being more communal and socialist. So, individualism is certainly a part of the story at some level, and many of these countries share a kind of spirit of individualism, but it's not the classically American version.
And I just wanted to add one more thing to the surprising things that you found out. You write about this, and I read this in Bella DiPaolo's book. She's a researcher on singles who has been on my show, and she did research, or she wrote about research, saying that never married women seem to be some of the most satisfied people with their lives, that if they've never been married, not if they were divorced and then split up. And I find that really fascinating because, of course, we have all this pathologizing that if you're single, you're sick and there's something wrong with you. And you do mention that, yes, there are people who are single because they're just broken in some way. but that there are people who really feel comfortable being individuals, and not because they want to throw out society and they hate people.
Well, it's true. I mean, I should be clear. You know, the great majority of Americans will get married. The rates are astoundingly high, around 90%. So it's a small number of people who never do get married, but they have surprisingly good outcomes on these measures, happiness and life satisfaction. It's actually pretty interesting. And one thing is, we know that if you are married and you experience a divorce or a breakup, or if your spouse gets very sick and dies, that is a very stressful experience that's bad for your health. And so people who live alone and don't get married don't have that risk. I think that what's remarkable today is that living alone really is not a kind of fringe phenomenon. And you went through the list of the reasons why people are living alone today, and my argument about the changes that caused it. But this point about urbanization is really crucial, because today, you know, if you live in a big city where there are a lot of singles, and I call them singletons, people who live alone or go solo, you probably live in a neighborhood where 50, 60, 70% of the households are one-person households. And that means that you can be alone and at home, but also very close to companions who can provide support. And so it's important to note that people who live alone are not mostly sitting in their apartments suffering from loneliness. They're out in the world and engaging in social life.
Absolutely. And I live in one of those communities, and I rent a little house, and my neighbors were on the same lot. And so I'll just go back there and knock on their door, or they'll, do you have an onion? Come over. And so we're very interdependent, even though I'm a girl who lives alone and they're a family. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I'm glad you used that point, because, you know, what I came to believe by the end of the many years I spent working on this book is, you know, not that living alone was a sign of radical independence, but that, you know, in fact, it's our interdependence as a society, or as societies today, that makes our independence possible. That's why living alone is so common in big, booming cities. It's why it's more common in affluent nations. It's why you find it, you know, in the Scandinavian countries, where they really do invest in the common good by, you know, supporting subsidized housing and having guaranteed health care and home care and all kinds of services that make it possible for people to live in the way that works best for them, regardless of what that is. So there's a way in which providing this kind of social connection and support frees individuals to live the kind of lives that work best at that time.
And now, this is an underlying message I keep getting from your book as I was reading it. I kept getting, and I'm talking with Dr. Eric Kleinenberg. His book is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. And I thought it's so important, if you're a single person, to be cognizant of the need to be interdependent, to not just say, okay, I'm single, and sort of slump over, that if you are single, it's not this built-in framework. It's sort of like a corporation when you have a family. And the message your book gave me over and over again was, recognize that you're single, recognize that you need to set up these relationships with people.
I think that's right. You know, and we know from the best research we have on health that being socially isolated really is dangerous. You know, if you don't have strong contacts, if you don't have access to good social supports, you're really at higher risk of a number of health problems. But if you are single or you live alone and you're well-connected, if you have a strong network, if you're engaged in the world, you get the benefits that you would get from being in a really healthy marriage. It's profoundly important. So that is a strong idea. And in fact, in the book, I spend a lot of time, you know, trying to identify some of the ways in which we can create places that work well for the world we live in now. I think we have to abandon this kind of fantasy that, you know, that we could go back to some previous moment of history and reorganize society so that we live the way we did in, say, the 1950s. We live in a world where enormous numbers of people are single and on their own. And the question is, how can we rebuild our cities and our suburbs to make living alone a less isolating experience?
And you had this great quote. I forget who it's from, if it's just your quote or someone's quote, because you interviewed countless people for this book. You said, nobody ever worries about dying married, as opposed to that. Oh, I hate that. Oh, you'll die alone. You know, it's so horrible. And people feel like social failures for living alone. But is that changing more and more, or how stuck in the past is that?
Yeah, look, it is changing. I should be clear, you know, in the 1950s, a group of psychologists at the University of Michigan did a survey of Americans' attitudes towards single and unmarried people, and they reported that somewhere around 80% of their representative sample thought that people who were single and were content to stay that way were either sick or neurotic or, my favorite, immoral. So, you know, today, you know, psychologists don't even ask people questions about their attitudes towards single and married people because we just accept that that's part of the world. So our attitudes have changed a lot, no doubt. But that said, there still is a stigma around being single and living alone. And as you surely know, you know, there are many situations in which if you're single and you walk into a room, everybody wants to talk to you about, you know, can they set you up with someone? Have you met anybody? What's happening in your dating life? And really, they're kind of projecting their own anxieties and issues onto you. But it's a very difficult situation. So, you know, it makes the holidays really stressful. You have to go back to your family and friends and confront this barrage of questions about what's going on. And, you know, then there's some other ways in which people experience discrimination, trying to get into a co-op in New York City, for instance, or I talked to a number of people who felt
what happens? Just tell us, because not everybody's from New York. What happens with the co-op if you're single?
Well, you know, there are many people who report that the boards that have to approve buyers for homes in certain New York City apartments, you know, look for married people because they have a sense that married people will be better neighbors, more responsible, and that it's harder for them to get into these buildings. I think far more widespread and consequential is the concern that if you're single and you're in an office, that if the managers think of you and define you as a single person, that they'll just presume that that means you're more available to do extra work on evenings or on the weekends, and they'll be more generous giving time off to people who have family responsibilities and say, you know, I need to get out of work to take care of X, Y, or Z thing. Whereas if you're single, you'll get dumped with extra responsibilities. And in the book, I have interviews with a lot of people who tell stories that probably will resonate with listeners who, you know, if they've experienced this kind of thing. So there are clearly, you know, many areas in which people feel discriminated against today. And you know, I think that we have come a long way, but this remains one of these categories that's hard for us to manage in life. It's a scary and strange idea for people to know that there are so many singles out there. And I continue to find people who are just stunned at how big the numbers are.
And you still see, you know, some of the same prejudices are there, where people won't invite the single person to dinner if it's all couples and everything. Like, you know, the people, unless it's one of those parties where they exchange the keys and you have to have two of everyone. Well, actually, it could have three. Never mind. It's not supposed to be really 30.
I don't go to those parties.
So.
I don't know.
Right, yeah. You have kids. But, you know, I don't understand why that is. I think people are sometimes uncomfortable. Oh, is that girl going to steal someone's husband or something? But you say increasingly the marketplace seems to be noticing single people that, you know, before travel, in a lot of ways, the world was just filled with bicycles built for two, and they're starting to have single occupancy rooms on cruise ships and other places. And so maybe that reflects what you're talking about, that more people are starting to recognize that single is not just some kind of sickness and you're immoral and all those other things.
Well, it's just too expensive to ignore on the basis of some, you know, outdated morality. I mean, let's face it. Singles are about half of the American adult population today. It's 49% of American adults are unmarried. People who live alone are 28% of all households, and there's 33 million people in this country. It's about a $1.9 trillion market for singles. And if you're a company, you're foolish if you're ignoring this demographic. I mean, look, we know that the political parties are now all too aware of the rise of singles. I mean, the two guys who chased more single women than anyone else in the United States in 2012 were Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, because they were trying to get the single female vote, you know, and they tried desperately to get it. So
I like how you put that.
Well, I mean, it's true, right? I mean, the numbers just are overwhelming, and you would have to be you just have to be crazy to miss this. So, you know, I think that it's inevitable. I mean, I'm not foolish about this. I know that we will always have people who, you know, complain about the ways in which this signals the end of some kind of moral decency, and they'll say this is about the collapse of community and values and all the rest. But I think the truth is that the world is changing. Our norms are changing. One reflection of our spirit of individualism, which is not just American but really quite global, is this notion that, you know, whereas once if you were living in a marriage and you were really unhappy or you felt lonely in the marriage, you would have to justify getting divorced to your friends and family. Today, if you're really, really unhappy in the relationship you're in or the marriage you're in, if you feel lonely and miserable, you have to justify staying in it. Because our belief today is that, you know, we have a responsibility to ourselves to pursue good and meaningful lives, and that we will be better to ourselves and also for the world if we're not lonely and miserable at home. And, you know, I think we're kind of voting with our feet. I think also people are not racing into marriage as early as they used to. I mean, Americans now marry later than ever before. On average, it's about 28 for men and 26 for women, and it's higher than that in most cities. And in fact, you know, people who marry over the age of 25 are much more likely to stay married than people who married when they're very early. So people are taking time when they're younger to figure out who they are and what they want and how they want to live their lives and what they're looking for in a partner. And that just means we're spending more time on our own.
It really seems like things have changed in a number of ways. One is, I think that American adolescence now ends at 30. That's my personal belief. And you wrote about some things, for example, how most young adults who live alone see it as a stage. And if you combine that with the fact that we grow up a lot later, if ever, and that we live a lot longer, it seems likely that maybe the new way of living will be to be accepting of having these serial partnerships, to not see it as a tragedy. And I'm not saying that mommy or daddy should walk out on kids. You know, I don't have any children, so if I were to break up with my boyfriend, which I wouldn't do because he's wonderful, but if I were to do that, there wouldn't be devastated children. There'd just be a devastated dog. So if you aren't leaving devastated kids, if your kids are in college and it's time to move on, maybe that'll start to become normal.
Well, yeah, I mean, so divorce rates are down, in fact, and that's important. But I think part of the reason for that is because people are taking longer to figure out what they want before they get married. I think the delay in the age of first marriage is probably a good thing. I think there are issues now about the increasing age of parents, and there's some health issues related to that we really need to understand better and to deal with. But I think the fact that so many people are living alone and staying single for longer stretches of their lives is just not necessarily a bad thing. It can be productive in many ways. If our notion is that the best measure of the health of society or individuals is, you know, how many people are married or whether some individual is married, then it's clearly bad. But if we have a more rich and robust notion of what a good life could be or what a good society could be, then this is just, you know, one of many factors, and you can live well either way.
We're going to get back to that idea of being single not being necessarily a bad thing and maybe being a good thing, living single, but I need to do a station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in therapy and research. My guest tonight is sociologist Dr. Eric Kleinenberg, and his book is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. His website is erickleinenberg.com, and on Twitter, he's at Eric Kleinenberg. So, Helen Gurley Brown, I love you because you're not a snob as a researcher. You can always tell the people who only quote, you know, Martin Seligman. You quote Helen Gurley Brown, who actually, I love her. She was a scream. She was a not very beautiful woman. In fact, she called herself a mouse burger. And she said, look, you don't have to be beautiful to get ahead. Basically, you have to have moxie and smarts and develop yourself. And she wrote in 1962, Sex and a Single Girl. And you quote, saying Brown's book was not a study on how to get married, but how to stay single in superlative style. And she called living alone not a means to subvert marriage, but a means to improve it, saying serving time as a single woman can give you the foundation for a better marriage if you finally go that route. And this is this message I saw over and over in your book, Going Solo, that living single is the way to have solitude, to develop yourself, that if you can look at that, if people who live alone can see the positive, tell themselves a different story about being single, this can help them get great things out of it instead of really feeling guilty and awful, like they should go, just go to a bar and drag the first person there home.
No, I think that's right. Look, especially today, you know, we live in a moment where we are so hyper-connected. We might even be over-connected. You know, we spend our time on the internet and on Facebook and Twitter and text messaging and instant messaging and emailing and socializing in our office places, which have become, you know, more like places to have a social life than they were in the past. And I think we're just exhausted from all of the chatter. And you know, living alone for many people is, you know, a way to get access to some productive solitude, and that solitude is something that we need. That was something that we've always needed. That's clearly, you know, one of the big themes of a major school of American philosophy. People like Thoreau and Emerson, the Transcendentalists. Not to get all fancy on you after you praise me for quoting.
Oh no, but I love that too.
But this is a really important part of what it means to live a good life. And you know, I think what's interesting is many people use their solitude to figure out how to make better connections once they come back into the world. And that's what Thoreau was doing, by the way, when he went to Walden Pond. That's what Emerson wrote about, not just to retreat from society, but to figure out how to make a better return. And so I think paradoxically, solitude can be a way to have stronger and better relationships. And clearly, spending time on your own as a young person or as a recently divorced or separated person can be a much healthier thing than racing into a relationship. When I have friends who get divorced and a few weeks later wind up, with the person who they say they're now going to spend the rest of their life with, I get really worried for them.
Yeah, when it's a reaction, when people are running to something because of loneliness, and that's where the advice in your book Going Solo comes in. And it's both tangible and then between the lines that you need to set things up for yourself where you have that solitude, but where you're not an island. And you write, I love the stuff you wrote about Walden Pond and Thoreau, where you said, you pointed out that, you know, he wasn't just, you know, out there so alone. He could go into town and connect with people when he wanted. And that's what I do. I have a book due in June, and I'm writing these crazy hours. My friends kidnapped me. We went out Friday night, and there's nothing so satisfying as when you don't see another human being for a while to go out and be amongst people. In fact, it is, you do feel that sense of solitude. A woman, a publicist for a book company, is in California, and she said she dropped a book off. And I said, oh, come in, because I realized I needed to talk to another human being, not just talk over the internet, to talk to somebody. You know, I see my boyfriend a lot, but just to talk to somebody I hadn't met before. And because it's very invigorating to do that. And so, you know, depending on your level of your need for connection, I'm an extrovert, you know, if you're an introvert, it's different, but you need to figure that out. And the solitude that you talk about can help you figure out what your needs are, how much you need to bring in community, and if you need basically to leave the house more often.
Yeah, no, that's right. We should remember that loneliness in and of itself is not necessarily such a bad thing. Having too much loneliness can be destructive and painful, obviously. But the psychologists who study loneliness tell us that it's really the body's kind of physiological cue to us that we need to get off of our couch and into the world and find companionship. So the experience of some degree of loneliness can lead us to the place where we need to go, into companionship. And, you know, we all do need to have those social ties, and that there's many ways we can get them. We make a mistake by thinking that, you know, the one way that we're going to become whole and stop feeling that loneliness is by going out and getting married and starting a family. And I can tell you a lot of people who suffer from loneliness and struggle with it wind up getting married and learn that that's hardly the solution to their problems. I want to be clear, you know, that this is not a book of advocacy. I don't really have an agenda here to convince you that you're going to be better off single or better off married. It's not that kind of thing. Instead, I noticed that there's been this incredible social change, and my job as a social scientist is to try to figure out how that happened and what it means, and given that it happened, what we can do to make people's lives better.
I like your book so much because the advice is not that heavy-handed stuff, but it is there. For example, this idea that loneliness is a healthy message. You talk about how women are more likely to reach out, single women more than their married contemporaries, as you said before. So they'll do things like see their or visit their best friend at least weekly, have a contact like call or an email exchange with a best friend at least weekly, spend a social evening with neighbors, be in these informal group activities, be a member of a secular social group. And so men reading that can realize, oh, women do that more naturally. We women evolved to be these joiners and nurturers, and men are more off, look, we're hunting, we hunt together, but we're sort of not going to talk too much. You know, right. Although I don't want to, there was recently that research that was all wrong about how men don't speak and women, you know, are chatterboxes, and men and women actually say the same amount of words per day per study on a college campus. So I don't want to mislead people, but it's just that women tend to be more social in that way, bringing friends together. And so if you're a man, you can look at that message and say, I can do these things. I can go to charity work. I can go out with a beer with guys. We can go out. There are these wonderful guys who come to a cafe I go to on Saturdays. They're a bunch of Buddhists, and they talk about being Buddhists and men. And I think that's probably really good for all of them.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is true that, you know, this is not universal, but women on average tend to do a better job making and also maintaining their ties to friends and to family members. Men are more at risk of getting isolated, and that's a real health issue. You know, I noticed that the first time when I wrote my book about the heat wave in Chicago, because men are actually much less likely to live alone than women, and even to age alone than women, but they were much more likely to die alone during the heat wave because there's such great risk of isolation, comparatively speaking. And that might be especially true for the older generation of men today, who I think really depended on their wives for, you know, taking care of the social calendar and, you know, establishing ties with them and others. But I see it in younger generations as well. There's some possibility that this rising generation of younger men who are so comfortable on social media and are using Facebook and instant messaging and Twitter and all kinds of other things to stay connected are going to get some advantages from that. They might have better capacity to connect with other men and women and maybe less propensity to be alone, but it's going to take a long time for us to learn that.
Yeah, social media is pretty important. I want to get into Quirky Alone, which I find fascinating, and Sasha Kagan, but I should do a little station ID, except I've lost my station ID sheet. Okay, so I'll just do it. I am talking with Dr. Eric Kleinenberg. His book is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. And Quirky Alone is a neologism referring to somebody who enjoys being single and generally prefers to be alone rather than just dating for the sake of it. Now, does this mean that they don't date or that they sometimes date?
No, not at all. And, you know, there's a woman named Sasha Kagan, whom I met in the Bay Area of California, who wrote this article about, you know, being quirky alone when she was in her 20s. And it was kind of before the big internet culture had really taken off, but the article went viral in the way that, you know, things could have gone viral back then. And it expressed the sense that there are a lot of people who just felt comfortable being with themselves and didn't feel like they needed to date just for dating's sake or needed to couple up just for the sake of satisfying other people around them. And, you know, they're by all means interested in dating, and many people who kind of identified as quirky alone ultimately settled down and found, you know, long-term intimate partners with whom they lived. But the notion was that they felt okay on their own and that they really wanted to challenge this notion that if you are single or going solo, there's something wrong with you. Clearly that's not the case.
And so Kagan, what's very interesting, she ended up sort of pushing back against this movement she created. There were all these people who were pushing back against this cultural pressure to marry, but then something happened, and it was that I think it was her aunt got sick. And so that sort of changed. Was it her aunt or her grandma? I can't find it in my notes.
Yeah, well, so she had an aunt who got very sick and needed a lot of support and care from people in her family. Her aunt was single and had been in many ways a model for her as she developed this idea about quirky alone. And, you know, her friends were able to help, but she really ultimately, you know, needed to rely on her family because they were just, you know, more willing to change their lives for her. And I think that was a bit of a shock for Sasha and that affected the way she thought. But that's not really the whole story. I mean, she also feels that, you know, people need to experience different kinds of things in life, and that she experienced being single and living alone for a long time, and she wanted to have the experience of finding a person with whom she could settle down, and she decided to spend more time and energy looking for that. And I think she wanted to kind of embrace the spirit of quirky alone, and she wasn't rejecting it, but was also trying to recognize the different elements of what makes for a rich life. And I think in that she's very much in the mainstream of American culture. I mean, the point today is not that people generally get married and then stay married forever, or that people make some kind of long-term commitment to going solo or being alone, quirky or not. What we do for the most part is move in and out of different conditions in our lives. You know, people live alone for some time and then they live with someone, maybe married, maybe not, but they live with someone for some time and they might live alone again and then live with someone again. There's a kind of fluidity in contemporary life that is quite normal. And I think we have a hard time speaking about it, but that's a hard one for me to understand because it really is something that so many people share.
Well, this is what I like in your book, Going Solo, that you chronicle all of this. It's, look, here are these natural stages, and we've had these sort of cartoon versions of what families are and what relationships are and how relationships play out, and you have a more realistic look. And you also asked Bella DiPaolo, who is a singles advocate, some very good questions. And this leads up to what I'm going to say now about, I have a friend, Kathy Sipe, who got cancer and unfortunately died. And you said, you know, it's one thing to live alone when you're healthy and successful, but what happens to people living alone when they get sick? And just to tell you about Kathy, a bunch of us, we became Team Kathy. She had a very strong network of friends. She was somebody who was this person who joined all these people in Los Angeles. She was my first friend here. She was very welcoming. You could be weird. She'd still like you. And so all these people, when she got sick, rose up and would go and drive her places and come over. And it's hard being around somebody with cancer because they're suffering. But, you know, people were there for her. And that's an example of how if you are a person, like she was a divorced woman with a daughter who had just gone to college, that if you build these strong networks, and it's fun. You don't just do it because, well, what if I get cancer? I need somebody to take care of me. You build them to have friendships, and it's a rich life. But then all of us were there for her till the end. And it was really an incredible thing. And you talk about that as a way to basically deal with that.
No, I think that's right. And I think that there are communities like that, you know, throughout the world today. You know, the fact that people are living alone is not a sign that people are misanthropic and want to be alone. And in fact, we have to make a very strong distinction between living alone and being alone and feeling lonely. We confuse and conflate those things so often, but the truth is that they're really different conditions. So a lot of people who live alone work quite hard to develop a social network. And as you say, not because they want to be protected, but because they want to enjoy their life. And the way to enjoy their life is to spend it with others. That when people do that really well, they find that they're able to get that support that they need if things go badly. And sometimes they get better supported. They get better support than they would if they were married and relied exclusively on one person. So, you know, there's no one right way to do it. And what I tried to do in this book is, you know, not to preach or to moralize, but to really do the best job I could to look at the evidence on how we live and what it means and what the challenges of different conditions are, and to report on what I found. So, look, not everyone who is living alone and single has the kind of network that your friend does, and that sounds like you do, and you're lucky and you work hard to have it. We need to think about what happens to people who live alone and don't have that capacity to develop ties very well, because for them, we really do need to find a better source of support, and we have failed to do that. But many people have made it work.
Yeah, we're going to get into that with the elderly, and it's sort of, there's something I wanted to lead up to the elderly with, but I just wanted to say what you're saying about these people who have friends that take care of them. You know, part of the thing where Helen Gurley Brown said, look, you know, you be solitary and you work on yourself and you better yourself. Part of having these good friendships is being a good friend, but not only that, because there's something Dr. Barbara Oakley writes about pathological altruism. You can think you're a good friend because you're everybody's doormat, and that's not right. You have to evolve as a person to be able to stand up for yourself so you're a friend with real friends and not a doormat. So then you have these interdependent relationships that are healthy and you're not just being used.
So that sounds completely right to me.
And so I wanted to get into something you talk about in the book, which is there's a name for it, co-housing. That's the name I know it by, where people move in around each other. You talk about in urban areas, they live in apartment buildings, but even in less urban areas, they have a bunch of houses together. And my neighbors and I talked about that they would build a place with a bunch of us. And I once lived in a place like this where there was a loft with a shared commons, a bunch of lofts, shared commons. So you can see people when you want and go inside and no one bothers you. But one of the features that we talked about was having old people there and a baby, and, you know, that it would be a community that's more like real life and not just that everybody's the same age with the same age kids and you know, and everybody has to have kids. Because that's a way to teach kids, for example, compassion about old people.
Yeah. No, I mean, there are lots of experimental techniques that people are using to remake their housing, to remake the terms of collective life. Co-housing is clearly one of the more exciting ones. I mean, they remain relatively small in the scheme of things. They're not as many as you would imagine, given how much the social organization of our families has changed, the social organization of society has changed. I expect that we'll find more of these things, just as pragmatic matters. The question of how to deal with older people who are living alone is really serious and difficult. You know, the boomers are now becoming senior citizens. The oldest boomers have just turned 65, and we already have about 11 million seniors living alone today. About a third of all people who live alone are over 65, and those numbers are going to grow and grow and grow in the coming years and decades. And, you know, today, if you're aging alone, if you're affluent, you can afford to move into one of these assisted living facilities, which, you know, provide people with both a private apartment where they can have the perception and experience of domestic independence, but also they provide social support and services and meals and programs and maybe trips to downtown and shopping, all kinds of good things. But for the overwhelming majority of American families, it's just prohibitively expensive. They're amazingly expensive. And we haven't really thought much about how we can expand or democratize access to places like that. We haven't thought about how to make assisted living facilities that are really high quality and pleasurable into places that that most people can access. And I think until we do, we'll have a real crisis on our hands.
And one thing that you wrote that I thought was a very smart thing was to be, if you can afford it, in this, have your elderly relative in an assisted living facility where it becomes something where they get more and more care as they need it. Because you see these people, and it's happened to a friend's mother, they have to uproot their elderly relative because the place no longer offers enough care for the state they were in. And hi, it wasn't enough, you know, it wasn't like, wow, what a surprise that she got to that point, because elderly people live a long time, they get Alzheimer's. And so that's something that needs to be thought of more.
No, I think that's right, and let's face it, we have a very hard time talking about this. I mean, it's not fun or sexy. It doesn't look good on television. We just haven't been able to focus our attention on this issue. But the truth is that all of us have an interest in talking about it, because, you know, how many people who are listening to our conversation tonight can say with total confidence that by the time they're in their 60s or 70s or 80s, they'll be living the way they're living now? Who knows if they're going to be married or single, living with family members or a domestic partner or friends or children. I mean, there's just so much unpredictability in each of our personal lives. It's hard to know how we'll be living then. So is it in our best interest to try to come up with a solution to this problem that works for people who are older and alone today, but it also works for us tomorrow?
Yeah, it's really important, because a lot of families, like yours, for example, you started paying for your grandma's care, and then it got really, really expensive, and not everybody can afford that, and so we're sort of just waiting for the axe to fall, and then we're in a lot of trouble with our elderly relatives.
I think that's right. I think, you know, many of us just kind of hope and pray that it doesn't happen to us, so that we come up with an easy answer. And if it doesn't, we don't really have a solution.
Now, this sounds sort of terrible, but actually, I mean, this is it. You wrote about it in your book, Going Solo. I'm talking with Dr. Eric Kleinenberg, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. And this is about robots. And actually, there was surprising success with robot dogs and the elderly. It just sounds horrible, but the research bore it out that they, you know, that whether they compared the, when they compared the regular dogs and the robot dogs, that they made people happy.
Well, they didn't have to take them out for walks, I guess. No, I mean, look, I mean, everyone, you know, if you write a book about living alone, you got to talk about animal companions and pets, and, you know, pets, if you're living alone, a pet can be a really terrific thing. And can provide real and meaningful companionship, except when they get really sick and start, you know, getting in trouble. And then for a lot of people, that can be economically burdensome. That, you know, can be hugely expensive to care for a pet. It can be stressful. So actually, the evidence on animal companions turns out to be more mixed than I thought it would be. I really thought it was going to be more of just a pure good. It also turns out that people who live alone are not the most likely to have pets. The people who are most likely to have pets are people who are married with kids.
I love that, because that's such a stigma on the alone dwellers.
Exactly. Like, they all have a lot of cats. But, you know, this robot thing, you know, I by no means was I advocating that we just find robot companions to take care of older
horrible people.
I don't think that. Let me be clear. But, I do think that we will see, we are already seeing all kinds of, you know, robotic machines being used to improve the lives of people who live alone in particular. And, you know, some of these are just like, you know, machines that give us better access to doctors, or that provide, you know, doctors with information about our, you know, our bodies, our vital systems, that could signal alert if we don't get out of bed. But increasingly, there are other kinds of robots that are being rolled out that do more, that assist in cleaning, that, you know, that send out signals when we don't do our ordinary routines, that provide a certain kind of companionship. They're not satisfying. They're not substitutes for human companionship, and it would be terrible and dangerous if they ever became that. But let's face it, you know, they're going to be machines in the homes of people who live alone, and they'll play a more and more significant role. There are obviously also lots of machines in the homes of people who live with others, and, you know, how many marriages are going to break up because one person's always complaining that the other goes to bed cuddling the iPad and not the person.
Yes, yes. And you made a point. One of the things with these robotic things that are being invented, that there are these things where they're like, there's a TV screen and it can move and you can have your relative talking there. So it is a source for connection if it doesn't become abused. Everything's a tool and we have a choice in how to use it. So I think that's an important part.
That's right. And, you know, I know that we live at this moment where we've become so concerned that, you know, social media are pulling us away from each other. You know, the Atlantic Monthly magazine had a headline cover story, you know, basically saying that Americans are more lonely than we've ever been and blaming the internet for it. And I got to say that there's no evidence for this whatsoever. Just complete fallacy that we're lonelier than ever. In fact, the people who are the heaviest users of social media are also the heaviest users of FaceTime. They are just social people who enjoy companionship and interaction. And, you know, a lot of older people are using Facebook now and Meetup and email and Skype to establish relationships or to see their family and to make new friends and to go out. So I think that, you know, this social media create a lot of social possibilities for us. And it is definitely true that you don't want to be in a taxi cab with a driver who's barreling down Fifth Avenue while, you know, talking to his friend on Skype video. That's bad news. But, you know, for the most part, these things are creating possibilities for richer social life.
I just finished a chapter on the internet where I make this point that, and I didn't have an ending to the chapter, and then this guy who's a FedEx pilot in Alaska who's been commenting on my blog since 2008 took my boyfriend and me out to dinner. He hopped a FedEx plane to LA. Another one of my blog commenters came. It's so amazing, and I realized, you know, the internet is a tool, and you just need guts and imagination to have it be a connecting tool rather than an alienating tool.
Well, I'll be waiting for someone to fly to me in New York City after this interview. We'll see what happens.
No, but people don't think about that. It's so incredible. You just have to ask people. And, in fact, I met my friend Kathy Seip because I wrote her a fan letter for her New York Press column when I lived in New York. And we have our circle of friends has this friend, Kate Coe, who we met because she commented on Kathy's blog. And so all it takes is that email you send, and you send another email, and you say, how about having lunch? And so people just have to realize, and that's the thing I love about your book, Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone by Dr. Eric Kleinenberg. It's filled with these sort of motivations to tell people, look, just notice this. This helps. Do this. If you did this, your life would be better. And I think it's really, really important to be cognizant if you're alone, you take this realistic view that, look, there are problems and you need to deal with them and be interdependent and create community and do these things to make your life not lonely but just solitary and solo for a while.
I'm with you. I'm not going to argue with that.
So we're almost out of time. Do you have just some parting words to leave people with to tell them? Just a final message about going solo, living alone, how to make this work for them.
Well, you know, like I said, I think that one thing to know is that you're not alone. Living alone is incredibly common, one of the most common ways of living in the world today. The new census just came out in Canada and in the United Kingdom in the last few weeks, and in both places it was reported that living alone is the most common household type, more common than being married with children at home. And that's just shocking. So it's just completely normal way to live these days. Second thing is that there is a lot of variation in people's lives. So this isn't really a topic that's just for people who are living alone today. This is relevant to you no matter how you're living, because who knows how you'll be living 3 or 5 or 10 or 25 years from now. And you probably have a lot of people in your social circle, your family and friendship circle, who are living alone today. This is just who we are. The important thing I would say is that living alone really does not mean being alone and shouldn't mean being alone. It can give you a chance to have solitude, but it also can give you a chance to go out and have a rich and meaningful social life. And most people who are going solo are profoundly social. They're out in the world, not sitting in their apartment. And if you can do that, you really can have a healthy and good life.
Thank you. Oh, this has just been great. Thank you so much, Eric.
It's been my pleasure.
Great show. My guest tonight has been sociologist Dr. Eric Kleinenberg. His book is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. You can find him on his website, erickleinenberg.com. That's erickleinenberg.com. And on Twitter, he's Eric Kleinenberg. Thanks again. This is just a great show.
Thank you.
Hey, Southern California, if you're an Edison customer, you have rate options. And if you like to save money, energy, or the environment, here's more good news. There could be a rate that works better for you. Find out everything you need to know about time of use rates, solar rates, electric vehicle rates, or green rates at sce.com/SoCalRates. Together, let's create a clean energy future. Southern California Edison. Energy for what's ahead.
Hi, can I park here?
Let's see. Well, sure, sign says 15 minutes from Miss LG and RK, so maybe...
I'm just going to the AT&T store for a deal that's LA only.
Should have taken a scooter. They're super mindful.
Hi, parking here?
He's going to the AT&T store for a deal that's LA only.
You didn't take a scooter? They're super mindful.
Are you a Virgo?
Hey, LA, come into an AT&T store and find out how to get a smartphone for free. AT&T, more for your bargain hunter thing. That's our thing. Limited LA offer. See store for details.